Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest today is Jordan Ifueko, author of Ray Bearer, an epic debut YA novel Kirkus calls a fresh, phenomenal fantasy that begs readers to revel in its brilliant world. Ray Bearer is inspired by West African storytelling, epic anime, the Western canon, so many elements entwined to make a world that's fresh, fully realized, and singularly compelling. The story centers around a girl named Tari Sai, who lives in the kingdom of Eretzar, which is composed of 12 realms. It is ruled by a king advised by a council of 11 representatives, who are more like chosen family than elected officials. Each one is bonded with the king in a profound way, to where it hurts them to be apart from one another. And the presence of each member of the council provides the king with immunity against a specific way to die, making him effectively immortal. Almost. Tari Sai has always yearned for a family, so when she's anointed to the junior council of the crown prince of Eretzar, it's the realization of a lifelong dream, but also, in a way, her worst nightmare. No spoilers from me. We'll ask the author how much more she'd like you to know. I will just end with this, also from our starred review of the book, quote, "With extraordinary world building and breathtaking prose, Ray Bearer is the story of loyalty, fate, and the lengths we're willing to go for the ones we love." Jordan Ifueko is a Nigerian-American author of young adult fiction. She lives in Los Angeles, California, with her husband David and their collection of Black Panther Funko Pops, which I love from her biography. She will join us from home soon. But first, a word from one of our sponsors for this episode, Amazon Original Stories, about their thrilling Hush collection. What is the truth? How do you trust what you think you know? In stories featuring conspirators, psychics, deceptive lovers, and desperate killers, some of today's most popular crime writers, including Ruth Ware, Oyinkan Breathwaite, and Lisa Unger, explore the very nature of truth and the risks in uncovering the lies. Read the Hush collection from Amazon Original Stories. Visit amazon.com/hush. And now let's talk with Jordan Ifueko, author of Ray Bearer. Welcome, Jordan, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're discussing your debut novel, Ray Bearer. So I must ask, what does it mean to bear the ray?
Well, it's funny because part of that is actually a spoiler, but I'll tell you what the culture in the world of Ray Bearer thinks it means to bear the ray.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So to the people of Eretzar, the global empire in which the story is set, the ray represents a divine selection by their premium deity, the storyteller, of who is worthy to rule the empire. And for 500 years, the ray has only been present in two people at any time, which is the emperor and his heir, which is always a boy. So that's what it means to the people of Eretzar to bear the ray. And if you bear the ray, evidence of your worthiness to rule is shown in your growing immunity to the 13 deaths of the realm. So for every person you anoint to your sacred council, you anoint your council who rule the empire with you when you're a child. So you all grow up together very intimately. But for every child you anoint to your council, you become immune to one kind of death. The exception being that any person you anoint can still cause you to die from one of those deaths. So if I anointed you, Megan, I might become immune to drowning, but you could still drown me. But you would be the only person in the whole world. So I'd have to be very careful that you were the right person.
Oh, I would never.
My counsel.
You can trust me.
Yes.
Okay. So that is a good reminder for me as the interviewer. I don't want to give any spoilers to our
listeners, because I would like for everyone to have the same joy at encountering this world you've built and moving through it that I did when I read the book. So if I do push a little bit too far, please push back, and and we'll be in this together. Okay, so I wanted to ask you, world building is one of my favorite words and one of my favorite concepts, and I want to know about how you built this world and if it was an endeavor that was led by a world or led by a character.
Oh, that's such a complicated question. So
yeah.
One of the interesting things about this book is that I actually started it when I was 13. So that's almost 14 years ago at this point. I went to this tiny little private high school in Oregon, and my graduating class was only 16 people. It was tiny. So we were just this group of teenagers who did everything together. And it was this kind of preppy school where we did lots of like debate and thinking about, you know, the nature of government and things like that. So like we took ourselves very seriously. And we just thought like our little group of kids that someday we'd like save the world in some way. So that's where this idea of a group of children who are being raised together to raise an to rule an empire came from. But when I was 13, you know, even though I was in love with fantasy, in love with the worlds that could be built, even though I loved fantasy, it was a genre that didn't love me back. Because as a young Black girl, you know, I had never seen myself represented in that genre. I can think of maybe one book that had a Black girl on the cover that was about a fantasy or a world building. I think it was Zara the Windseeker. I might get that name wrong. I think it was a Nnedi Okorafor book. But anyway, all that to say, when I first started writing The Global Empire of Eretzar, it was extremely vague. Like I was trying to, at that point, I already knew that I wouldn't relate to like a really Eurocentric setting, but at the same time, that was all I knew and I was trying to fit in. So it was like super vague. Like all the characters had these kind of Afro-Latin names and their clothes were super just kind of drapey. And, you know, it was kind of hard to decide what this place looked like, what the people even looked like. And then as I wrote and rewrote and rewrote this story, because it was the story I learned how to write a book on, I realized that cultures are specific things and that's kind of what makes them cool, you know? And so I tossed all of that out. I went really specific. Like each of the 13 realms in the book are loosely based on very specific cultures. The ruling kingdom of the empire is based strongly on the Yoruba, which is my mother's tribe in Nigeria. The Yoruba had an extensive empire themselves. It was like almost the entire west coast of Africa at one point.
Right.
I think it might have been the 1400s. Maybe it was a little earlier. Anyway, all that to say, I had so much fun coming up with each culture and trying to think of like the magic that would be inherent and unique to each of those places. Yeah, there was the Yoruba. There are other center kingdoms based on the Shona people of southeastern Africa. There's one that's kind of a mix of different tribes in Kenya. And then there are ones from other parts of the world, like Songland, to many people will be very recognizable as loosely based on medieval Korea. I had so much fun. It felt like a big house party I could invite anybody to.
It felt like a party. Once you tuned this in, you know, like once it started to really draw into vision and sharpen up, was it hard to abide by the rules you'd set for yourself?
Not really. Weirdly, it actually made it easier.
Oh.
I feel like the stricter parameters you give yourself, it's, at least for me as a writer, the more I have to work with. I think when guidelines are really vague, it's actually harder for me. Whereas when I decided, okay, you know, the people of Oluwan are based on the Yoruba, I already had a really good jumping part for, okay, well, what's important to them? You know, they'll have a culture of oral history and oral storytelling. The griots play a big role in the book. Griots are real people who've existed in West Africa for hundreds, if not thousands of years. They're like oral historians and poets and storytellers and musicians. They're all of those things. And they held very high places in society because they were one of the only people who could, at least in some of the realms, they were one of the only people who could kind of correct the ruling monarch,
right?
You know, through a story. Like, you can't contradict the monarch directly, but you can say, oh, you know, my oba, there was a story in which this person did this stupid thing you were about to do, and I'm going to tell you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I did find that having a specific culture actually made it easier for my imagination to go wild.
Right.
Yeah.
I love the griot, and also it's kind of like a, you know, akin to the fool who probably knows the most of anybody in the room, but is going to amusingly unspool their truth, and you may take from it what you may. The first time I encountered the word griot, it was in the work of Tracy Baptiste. Have you ever read any of her books?
I've heard the name. I haven't read her books.
Yeah, her works are set in Trinidad, and you know, especially during Carnival, you know, the griot that is like the time to come out and to be dressed and to spin these beautiful stories that, you know, oftentimes speak truth to power.
That's so cool. I didn't know they also called them griots in the Caribbean, but that actually makes loads of sense because most of the Black people in the Caribbean are from Ghana. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So I was fascinated to see how they were kind of this priesthood in your world.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of how it's interesting to hear the experience of people who don't know a lot about West African culture reading Rebearer, because it's hard for them to parse out what is West African culture and what is my imagination.
Right.
And so griots aren't considered priests in West Africa necessarily. They're just very revered. And so I liked playing with that and giving them this literal spiritual role in the world of Rebearer.
Can we speak a little bit directly about the character of Tari Sy?
Absolutely.
She became a beloved character to me. She seems to be beloved by you. What do you love about her?
Well, I guess I should also say that Tari Sy is the protagonist, because I'm not sure if I said that earlier. But Tari Sy is very special to me for a lot of reasons. I love stories where the hero isn't immediately the hero. Mm-hmm. One of the things I like about her story arc in particular is that she buys into the propaganda of the empire. You know, she spends quite a bit of the book trying to fit into this role that she's told she's supposed to fit into, which involves a lot of imperialism and misogyny, even though it's kind of like this benevolent misogyny where it's just like, oh, you are esteemed. You are one of the female anointed ones, and you have such a valuable role in the empire as a baby maker. You know, And there's one point where, you know, the prince, the Rebearer prince that she has sworn her loyalty to, is making the wrong call. And she has to actively restrains her intellect, basically, to correct him, because she feels like anything that contradicts him is part of this evil in herself that she's certain is going to hurt him someday. And yeah, that's, I think a lot of girls who come from more fundamentalist backgrounds can relate to that. I know I can.
Right.
I grew up in an environment where gender roles were, you know, very proudly taught, and it never quite felt right to me, but because it was all I knew, I really did I tried to swallow it all. I tried to do the right thing. And I loved getting to personify that in a physical way in Tari Sy. Her chest burns, like there's something actively trying to get out whenever she hears something that's just not fair, that doesn't make sense, that doesn't seem right. And she calls it a demon, that burning in her chest, you know, and she's always trying to exorcise it and get rid of it. So, yeah, I like that Tari Sy isn't kind of an insta-hero. Instead of just saying, like, I, you know, scoffed and said, that's ridiculous. It's more like, I've felt this conflict in myself and I tried to do the right thing, you know, which is obvious, I would hope, to the reader is the wrong thing, but not to Tari Sy.
Right. There's competing types of right, and we've all faced that before, and that is the continuing struggle of, you know, trying to be a moral actor in an unjust system.
Absolutely.
So it was really interesting to explore that through her. And also there's kind of like in her and like in some of the other characters, we see the struggle of maybe facing some things about yourself that are hard to grapple with, hard to reconcile with the good person you know yourself to be. And I kind of got the message, you know, just from, again, I'm trying to speak vaguely because I'm trying not to spoil anything for our listeners. But it kind of communicated to me that, you know, sometimes for these characters, progress is not possible without looking inward and kind of facing some of those things that may be hard to admit about themselves.
Absolutely. I guess that this might be a good point to bring up for the listeners. One of the main conflicts of the book is that Tarisai was conceived to commit a very specific murder.
Right.
Her mother conceives her with a djinn. I call them an alagbatos in the world of Eretzar. They're like guardians of natural resources. And so her mother enslaves one and kind of like makes it be her genie for three wishes. And one of her wishes is that the genie will conceive a child with her. So her last wish is dormant in the blood of her own child, meaning at any point she can command her child to fulfill this wish. And her child will have no choice but to fulfill it. And the wish is that she commits this specific murder. And Tarisai later learns that the person she is to kill is someone that she will grow to love very much. In fact, she kind of has to love him in order for the murder to take place in a very unfortunate turn of events. So I think she addresses this, what she perceives as this evil in herself, in a number of ways. First, she actually tries to deny that it will happen. She right. just says, nope, it's not going to happen. I'll make myself forget it. I'll be fine. And then when that doesn't work, she goes to the other extreme, which is to say, I have to be this person. I have to be the monster my mom created. All I can do is try and put as much distance between me and everyone I love as possible. I'm a monster. I'll only ever be a monster. And part of the book is her reconciling those two extremes. You know, you can't deny. I think it's kind of a good metaphor for our own demons and natures. You know, if you try and say they aren't there, that's a very ineffective way to deal with them. But if you act like it's a foregone conclusion, then you'll never actually try and grow out of them. So yeah, she has to find that very precarious balance.
Now that we've opened it up a little bit and we have a little more information, I would like to speak a little bit about her mother, if we may. She's referred to as the lady. This was a fascinating character to me. What was it like for you to write the lady?
It was really fun and really difficult because, and the lady is not named. She is not given a name. And that's part of her story. One of the first things you hear her say when she's summoning this alagbato is, I would tell you my name, but as you know, my father never gave me one. And it's just this very weighty baggage she carries of being cast aside at a young age for reasons out of her control, which is about as much as I can say without it being a spoiler. And what I find interesting about the lady is that I think a lot of us children of mothers or fathers will relate to this, in that she sees her daughter as an extension of herself, which doesn't mean she doesn't love her daughter, but she loves her in a very objectifying way, you know, where it's like you're not really your own autonomous person. Right. You are an extension of myself. And so when you don't reflect me, it feels like a betrayal. You know, it's not just a disappointment. It's you are actively betraying me by not basically acting as an extra limb for me, doing exactly what I expected you to do. Right. You know, and fulfilling the role in the story that I have written at your conception, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's as villainous as that might come across in the book at some points. I keep hearing from preview readers that they have experienced very similar relationships with their parents. It's funny, no matter how old the reader, they always relate to the daughter in the relationship. Rather than the mother I found.
Right.
because all of us have been the child of parents at some point.
mm-hmm. That's so, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think maybe the more history you have, the more your particular family culture is steeped in the history and acknowledging your ancestry and where you came from, the stronger that can sometimes be, right? The you are an extension of not just me, the parent, but of a family line.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting because there's definitely a little bit of the pressure of being the child of immigrants reflected there, just in that there are all these expectations, not just in terms of like, you know, we did all these things so that you could be a success. But I think specific for me as a Black child as well, you know, I was always told by my parents, like, you know, you are part of this long legacy. It's like anything you do reflects on all Black people, not just you, which is wildly unfair, but also true in the country that we live in. So I think this pressure Taresai learns to bear is something that came very naturally to me to write. I do think that Taresai's position is really unique, or at least I'm not sure if unique is the right word. It was really interesting for me to write because she actually comes from a position of power within the empire. Like very quickly in the book, she is assimilated into this kind of inner echelon of the Ray Bearer and his favorites, you know? Right. And so the conflict she grapples with is she grapples with both being a person of privilege in a corrupt system and with being an underdog in that system, in being a girl. So I don't know. I found that really interesting to work with. I related to it in, you know, being a woman and being Black and being disadvantaged in those ways, but also in being American born, you know, and realizing that what I was taught about my country growing up, you know, was in some ways very much propaganda, you know, of an imperialist empire. So just grappling with those two worlds of, yes, I'm disadvantaged in the system, but also look at all of the advantages I have over other people, is something that Taresai very much has to deal with as a character.
So I'm looking at the copy of the book I have right now. It has what I would call an absolutely gorgeous cover.
Thank you.
Did the image confirm your own ideas about what Taresai looks like?
Oh, it was wonderful. Mm. I tried not to get too specific with like a really, really specific face, at least early on in the process. I knew she had dark skin. I knew she had ethnically West African features. But the moment I was given a face, the moment I was given that cover, I felt so inspired. I love the pride in her expression, but I also love the softness. You know, that's another one of my favorite things about Taresai is that she is at heart a very affectionate and even gentle person, you know, for the majority of the first book until she goes through a certain development. All she wants in the world is a family. All she wants is her mother's approval and the love of her best friends. And that's just all she cares about. Mm-hmm. And I think that I've just seen so many, like in the rare occasion that a Black girl is represented as the main character or more often as the side character, it's just always this kind of very sassy, strong, bulletproof kind of stereotype. Right. And I remember not being able to relate to that very much as a Black girl growing up because I was very vulnerable. I was very sensitive. I was very romantic. You know, I was this sappy, you know, young teenager. And it was interesting coming up against that stereotype, even with my friends who loved me and knew me, when they had to make snap judgments about me, they would, at least my friends who were, you know, mostly white at that, my high school was in Oregon. And it was interesting seeing them put me back into that box, despite knowing me as a person sometimes, you know, and I really hated that. I didn't relate to that at all. So it was really important to me to have Taresai's vulnerability front and center for a good deal of the book. And also to celebrate that you can be a heroine, you can be someone who brings about justice and even revolution while still being a very soft person, you know?
Yeah, that's so interesting to me. I had the privilege of interviewing Danielle Clayton when The Bells came out. I don't know if you're familiar with that. That's now
I
a
am.
Series.
She's wonderful.
She's wonderful. And she said something interesting, too, which was like, to her, the fantasy stereotype that she wanted to work against with her protagonist was the plucky thief. She's like, you know, everybody thinks they're going to get the plucky thief here. She's like, I want this pampered girl. I want this ambitious girl. Mm-hmm. You know, I want her. And she can be so much more, too. You know,
she
like and she was.
I remember that about that book. I had the privilege of getting to talk to Danielle about that a couple of weeks ago. And I did recognize that about her character is one of the things I found surprising. I think in the very first chapter is that, you know, she is this, you know, very, very feminine, you know, privileged, pampered girl. But like the moment she has to compete for something, she's like, oh, gosh, I love my friends, but I actually kind of really want to be the favorite. Like, I need to be the favorite, you know, and I loved that juxtaposition. It wasn't the plucky thief, but it also wasn't just like, you know, friendship is the only thing worth striving for. It's like, she's like, no, I kind of want the job, though. there are lots of good things I could say about The Bells, but I also did enjoy that aspect.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
One other thing I enjoyed about Ray Beer, I mean, many other things I enjoyed about Ray Beer, but one thing was it was so lush and like such a visual reading experience for me. There's so many textiles and like clothing and it's sensual, like food and, you know, I could smell and see and different hairstyles and like it was, the fashion is... It was very vivid.
Oh,
and I love
you.
The attention you paid to all of those details.
That was definitely one of the aspects I enjoyed the most, for sure. I am a big clothes person and fabrics person, which is probably immediately obvious to anyone who reads anything I've ever written. I think that's a very West African fixation, I guess. When I think about Nigeria in particular, I just think of all of the different kinds of textiles. There are so many. The process with which they're dyed and designed and made is just enormous. And I only got to really include a little bit of that in the book. Mm-hmm. I think there's one point where I describe how wax dyed cloth is made. You like you draw a design with wax and then you kind of boil the cloth and water so the wax melts away. But the water you're boiling it in is dye. So when you take it out, what's left is like the wax design. It's kind of a different color and it's really intricate. All that to say, I did so much research that didn't get to go into the book because, you know, you have to actually pay attention to the plot at some point and you can't just write about pretty clothes for 400 pages, which I absolutely could. But I really enjoyed that. It'll also be obvious to anyone who reads the book that plantain is my favorite food in the world.
If I was forced to wager a guess, I would have guessed plantain.
Yes.
So I already got a little preview on this when we were chatting right before we launched the conversation. But will you continue the story in another book?
I will. Book two is, as I was telling you, due tomorrow to my publisher. So I have been burning the 3 a.m. oil trying to polish up this book. And it's a book I've really fallen in love with. I wasn't actually sure I would at first just because I've never had to write a book this quickly. Ray Bearer took me about 12 years to write. And I had to write at least the first draft in 9 months. Oh gosh. I just realized I said the story, the book title, and I wasn't supposed to. Maybe you can bleep that out.
Okay. We will make a note of it. We will bleep it
out.
Thank you. Okay. This anonymous book.
Yes. Book two.
Book two. Okay.
Yeah. It was really inspiring seeing the extent of my own ability, like what can I write, how much of this world can I cram in 9 months. I think it's something I'm really proud of. I think that Tari Sy gets her, I think she gets her journey, you know. I think I did it justice, so I'm excited to be able to share that in 2021.
Well, I'm excited to get to read that in 2021. And to me, I could see a book for every member of the council and then some. You know, like I have unlimited enthusiasm for the expansion of this world you've created.
Oh, thank you. You know, I could too. And it does grieve me that I didn't have time to expand on her relationship with every member of the council, because that's one of my favorite aspects of the books are the friendships, for sure. You know, she actually does have a special, unique bond with every person in her council because they're bonded mentally through this Rey power. And they all come from such different cultural backgrounds and have different passions and what they think they bring to the empire. Because as the reader finds out, not only do they rule the empire together, but they have specific roles. Like one person is in charge of, she's called the High Lady of Harvest. So she's in charge of all of the agricultural aspects of the empire. And one person's in charge of all of the like literary and cultural and musical parts of the empire. And, you know, it's just,
yeah,
it's like getting to have a dream job with all your best friends in your head.
And one of the beautiful things that like it, you do write very movingly about friendship and about these bonds. And it's like one of the things that these characters can do for one another in times of strife is when some characters are having a hard time finding the good in themselves, those friends can see it. They can be the ones to see it and build them up from the outside.
Absolutely.
When they're losing hope.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is explored even more in book two, actually, because by book two, you know, I'm not going to spoil the end of book one, but her priorities have shifted and she's not sure if she can, like with what's newly important to her to accomplish as a person, she feels very inadequate. And her friendships play a big role in, I guess, in helping her stay grounded. And when, and in fact, when she kind of neglects those friendships to try with all these new ambitions, like it becomes very apparent that she needed them, you know, to kind of stay who she is and kind of walk the tightrope between caring about big world concerns and only caring about, you know, your inner circle of friends and family.
Well, I believe we've been able to walk the tightrope between giving enough information about Rey Bearer and book two to make listeners really excited for both of them. So, Jordan, is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know, or will that do it?
I am so grateful for any of them to experience the world of Rey Bearer. Real quick, I guess I will do a plug for the audiobook version as well. The American version is narrated by Janice Abbott Pratt, and the UK and I guess international version is narrated by Weruche Opia, and they both do a wonderful job. So if you're an audiobook person, grab that from, you know, your favorite bookstore or Libby. Yeah, I just really hope they get their due because they brought so much life to this story.
I can't wait to check that out. So thank you. Thank you, Jordan, for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jordan Ifueko, author of Rey Bearer, out today from Amulet Books. Highly, highly recommended. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books this week. We have Young Readers editors Vicky Smith and Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Starting with Vicky, what's your pick for the week?
Well, my pick for the week is a book called Finish the Fight, The Brave and Revolutionary Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote. As folks may be aware, 2020 is a year of many, many, many anniversaries, and one of them is of the 19th Amendment. So there have been a number of pretty good books about the suffrage movement that have come out this year. But what makes this one really stand out is that it does not confine its discussion to Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. In fact, it really de-emphasizes them so that it can shine a really much more inclusive light on the women of color and the queer women and the Black women and Indigenous women who were part of the suffrage fight. Their introduction kind of says it better than I just did. They say, "But there are tons of women beyond Susan and Elizabeth's demographic who helped make suffrage a reality for all women. African-American women such as Frances Ellen Watkins Harper and Mary Church Terrell, who championed both suffrage and civil rights. Native American women such as Suzette LaFleche Tibbles and Jinkala Shah, who worked to achieve civil rights for Native people. We wanted to tell the stories of queer women like Angelina Weld Grimke, Latina women like Jovita Idar, and Asian American women like Mabel Pinghua Lee. They all fought for the vote as part of a broader struggle for equality, but their stories still aren't nearly as well known as they should be." And so in addition to telling the stories of these women who have been largely ignored by mainstream kids publishing, they also emphasize that it didn't end in 1920, that women are still struggling to get their seats at the table as full realized human beings. So it's a great, great entry in this anniversary year.
Vicki, this looking at seeing that you were going to be talking about this book got me thinking about Veronica Chambers, who edited it. She's just such an interesting writer slash editor. I first became aware of her like decades ago. She wrote a memoir called Mama's Girl, which was so good. And then I think she's written mostly young adult books, and she's ghostwritten and she's edited a lot of collections. She's just been kind of all over the place. And so I was looking back to see what Kirkus had said about Mama's Girl when it came out. And it mentioned that she was, at that time, she was a former contributor to Kirkus. So I guess she used to review for us a long time ago, which was interesting.
Yeah, she has, you know, multi-talented, certainly describes her. So yeah, thank you for bringing her other work up. I if you hadn't said, "And she was a Kirkus reviewer," I was going to bring that up too, because I think that's one of the coolest things.
I didn't know that.
She did not overlap with me at all, but I feel connected anyway.
Yeah.
The book is Finish the Fight, The Brave and Revolutionary Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote by Veronica Chambers. Thanks, Vicki, for that pick. Next, we've got Laura's pick. Laura, hello. What do you have for us?
So this week, I have a book that actually came out last week, but that means you can rush out and buy it right now or order it online safely. And this is a book I can't stop recommending to people. It's called Sia Martinez and the Moonlit Beginning of Everything. It's by Raquel Vasquez Gilliland. And it is a book that we called genre-defying, which is pretty much what it is. It's a bit of romance, a bit of science fiction. It deals with contemporary, very realistic issues. And it's about Sia, the Martinez family. They're a Mexican-American family living in Arizona. And Sia's mother has been missing and is presumed dead after this racist white sheriff in town basically targeted her, figured out she was undocumented and had her deported. And she tried really hard to re-enter the country, you know, trying to get a visa and so on. And when that didn't work, she attempted to cross the Sonoran Desert herself and was not seen from or heard from again. So Sia's dealing with this grief, with this anger. She goes to school with the sheriff's son who taunts her. But then things start happening. So there's a mysterious new boy who she has a crush on, or sort of, I would call it, initially she's very irritated by him, but he likes her. And then, so there's chemistry there. But also a spaceship lands and her mother's inside it. So that's a big turn of events. And it leads to, I can't get into too much because there would be spoilers, but there's this whole cosmology around the saguaro cactuses and her abuela, who is no longer in this world but is very much present and sort of manifests, like speaks to her but also manifests in terms of fragrances. Like there'll be this wonderful smell, lavender or something, and that's her grandmother there. But it's this really kind of gut-wrenching and beautiful and hopeful book.
Yeah, Laura, I when I saw that you were going to be talking about this book, I looked up the review, and like the third sentence is, "Together they spot a spacecraft bearing Sia's mother," which I think is like the most, you know, grab your collar and shake you line you can plant into a review that begins, "Grieving Sia is plagued daily by the sheriff's hateful son," because it's totally not at all what you're expecting. And I have not read it. I'm looking forward to reading it, but I totally understand why you are so excited about it just from hearing you talk and reading the review. What a cool sounding book.
It really is. And yeah, it's got a little bit of something, I feel like, for, you know, people who enjoy particular genres or even just, you know, realistic fiction. It's, yeah, not to be missed.
The title is Sia Martinez and the Moonlit Beginning of Everything by Raquel Vazquez Gilliland. Thank you very much, Laura, for that pick. Turning to nonfiction, we've got Eric's choice. Eric, what's it going to be?
I'm going to go timely here. It's All right. a collection about the pandemic. I know it sounds sad, but it's actually a really, really moving book. It's called And We Came Outside and Saw the Stars Again, Writers from Around the World on the COVID-19 Pandemic. And it's edited by Ilan Stevens, the Mexican-American writer and educator. And there's, what, I think 50-plus contributors in here. And it's really just a kind of who's who of contemporary writers like Jhumpa Lahiri, Claire Massoud, Ariel Dorfman, and a couple dozen others. And obviously what's most impressive about this is the view from all the way around the world. So you get some stuff from Argentina. You get somebody who was quarantined in Copenhagen. There's a contribution by a writer who was raised in a refugee camp in Gaza, who's locked down in Berlin. And he says that it, quote, brought back memories from the first intifada. So it's a lot of really moving essays, poems. There's photos, artwork. It's just a really good book that you can read front to back, but you could also just dip into as you see fit. And, you know, as this pandemic continues to seemingly grow and morph and evolve, it's really good to see these perspectives. You know, most of the books I've seen so far have been either just on the mechanics and the biology of the COVID-19 virus or US focused. So this is like a really good global look at what is a global problem.
Eric, I was thinking about how one of the dynamics with the pandemic that's caused additional sort of tension and stress for people has been how hard it, some people are sort of generalizing about experiences. And in reality, everyone's experiencing it quite differently. We're all going through a pandemic, but there's a lot of variation. It sounds like this book has such a variety of stories that it would, lots of different people could really find themselves reflected in it. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, that's a great point. You're right about, you know, we're all, everyone is suffering in some way, but everyone's also suffering in a very specific way. And I think this does a good job of representing all those different viewpoints. And it's very diverse in its contributors, subject matter, and areas of the world. So I highly recommend it.
The title once more is And We Came Outside and Saw the Stars Again, edited by Ilan Stevens. Thanks, Eric, for that choice. Finally, we have Fiction with Lori. Lori, what have you picked for us?
I have a book called The Boy in the Field by Margot Livesey. She is, I don't know if you know her. She's one of these writers who has been writing for a long time. You know, her books are consistently great. I think we've given stars to almost all of them. You know, she's not a huge name, but she's really consistent. If you, you know, like one of her books, then you'll be so happy because she's got this whole backlist that you can dive into. Her books are, they remind me of Carol Ann Shaw, who I think I talked about a few weeks ago, who's one of my favorite writers, who gets very deep into characters and kind of complexity and ambiguity in people's desires and their lives, in kind of ordinary lives. But Livesey always has this edge of, there's no way that I would ever say her books are thrillers, but there's always kind of an edge of tension. In this book, The Boy in the Field, what kicks off the action is these three teenage siblings who live near Oxford, England, are walking home from school one day, and the sister spots something off in a field, and they walk over to see what it is. And it's a boy lying in a field. And they realize that what they took to be his red socks was actually blood. He's been stabbed and he's lying there and he's breathing very softly, but he is alive. They kind of feel him and hold his hand, see if he's breathing. And then, you know, the youngest brother goes off to the road to try to flag somebody down to get help. And while they're waiting for help to come, the boy says one word, and Livesey just says, you know, they all heard it. He said one word, they all heard it. And then over time, you discovered they all thought he said something different. One of them thought he said coward. One of them thought he said cowrie, like a shell. One of them thought he said cowslip. And I just thought that was perfectly Livesey, you know, just the kind of ambiguity, the impossibility of really knowing other people or what happened. And so seeing this boy in the field kind of propels each of these teenagers on their own journey. The oldest boy kind of plays detective a bit. The daughter has a love affair with a graduate student. And all these different things happen, spurred by their discovery. And they do eventually meet the boy who they found in the field, who has recovered. And, you know, so they learn more about his story, which also has a lot of ambiguity. It's just very interesting and complicated and really readable also.
Well, I'm also glad you mentioned the backlist, because I have a plug for her nonfiction book from a few years ago, 2017. It's called The Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing. And we also gave that a star. And a lot of what you talked about, she goes into, there's a lot about her process, but it's a very good mix of not just her process, but also things that can be used universally for writers. Mm-hmm. So I highly recommend that if you want to see some of her nonfiction, which she hasn't done much of, a little bit for magazines, but this is her only book of nonfiction.
She's a good book critic too. So I bet her book about writing is good. She's
definitely, it's very solid. Yeah.
That title one more time is The Boy in the Field by Margot Livesey. Thank you, Lori, for that choice. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. Please do so again next week when my guest will be David Heska Wambly Wyden, author of Winter Counts, out from Echo on August 25th. He is an enrolled member of the Suchongo Lakota Nation, and his breakout thriller centers on a vigilante from the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota who goes to battle with a drug cartel. You won't want to miss it. But until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.